shut the government down, you shut it down. You shut it down. I went through this once. It wasn't a good thing.
Alaska's congressional delegation weighs in on the talk of a government shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers consider arming village public safety officers.
It is unreasonable to expect peace officers to be unarmed in communities where virtually every household has firearms.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Senate passed a measure advancing a government funding bill yesterday that zeroes out money for the Affordable Care Act. Both senators, Meg Murkowski and Begich, supported the measure, and Congressman Don Young supported it in the House last week. Joining us to explain what's happening and how this relates to a pending government shutdown is APRN's Washington correspondent Peter Granitz. He says Begich supported the measure to make sure Congress maintains funding for the health care law.
That sounds confusing because it is. This is the first procedural step in a Senate vote. He joined 99 other senators in voting to open up debate. When you open up debate, it means you can actually amend the bill. So the House passed this bill that said we will keep the government operating. That's called your continuing resolution bill. The House passed that with a provision zeroing out money for the Affordable Care Act. Now, that got sent back to the Senate. That's what they're debating now, and it's expected that Majority Leader Harry Reid would bring up an amendment that, this is where it gets particularly wonky, would strip the defund Obamacare language, meaning it would actually add the money back in, and then that would go back to the House. So it is a fiercely political vote. Last week, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor actually singled out Senator Begich and some other vulnerable Democrats in the Senate who are from Republican-leaning states, saying, you know what, I want to see how they vote on this. I want to see what they do. And when that vote comes up that Senator Reid will bring up, it's only going to need 51 votes. So it's interesting to see where Senator Begich will come down on that.
Peter, it appears that the Senate will pass the continuing resolution once as expected. As you said, Senator Reid will strip out the provision that would take funding away from the Affordable Care Act, essentially putting funding back for the Affordable Care Act, and then they will pass that continuing resolution. What does that mean once the Senate passes that?
This continuing resolution would go back to the House, and the House would need to pass that, and that's a big if. That's where the shutdown comes in. But it would keep the government open, operating at the current levels, the current spending levels for the next 2 months. That's not a lot of time. I spoke with Congressman Don Young. He wants a full year continuing resolution. Senator Mark Begich says he supports the idea of a 2 month continuing resolution, because he says that gives more time for the appropriations committees to do their work and to pass the appropriations bills. He is an appropriator. His counterpart in the Senate, Senator Lisa Murkowski, is also an appropriator. And I talked with her, and she said it's just completely unreasonable to think that it's possible both chambers pass and reconcile their appropriations bill in this two-month window.
Is it realistic that we get them all done? That's really, really, really pushing it. We all want to believe, but it's really pushing it.
So what's the point of this two-month thing instead of a year?
I think to hold our feet to the fire. We seem to do better with a clock ticking.
And Lori, the real story comes this weekend when the Senate does send its version back to the House. Speaker John Boehner has a really tough decision to make. He will need to decide whether to take up the Senate bill that effectively has put the money back in for the Affordable Care Act, or he could say, no, I'm going to go with the will of my party and not pass that, or amend it and take it out again. And then, you know, October 1st, it's the new fiscal year. So the time is running very, very short.
Peter, what does Congressman Don Young say about this?
He says that cutting money for the Affordable Care Act is a worthy cause. It's something he supports, but it is not worth shutting down the government.
When you shut the government down, you shut it down. You shut it down. I went through this once. It wasn't a good thing.
So, Peter, what's next?
The clock is running. In the Senate, the next vote could come as early as Friday or late Sunday evening. Then it's back to the House. And, you know, all the while, the debt ceiling is hovering over this debate. If there's a government shutdown as early as next week for a couple of days or a few days, that's nothing compared to what will happen if the government does not raise the debt ceiling.
All right, Peter, thanks for keeping an eye on these negotiations and the ongoing issue with this vote.
You bet.
That was APRN's Peter Granitz at the Capitol in Washington, D.C. An effort is underway to allow village public safety officers in Alaska to carry guns. VPSOs are currently precluded from being armed, but the shooting death of a VPSO officer in the Bristol Bay region earlier this year has resulted in an effort to change the rules. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
When the members of the Alaska legislature return to Juneau in January, they'll be presented with a piece of legislation that would allow village public safety officers in Alaska to carry firearms. The issue was addressed at length Thursday during an informational meeting sponsored by District 36 State Representative Bryce Edgman from Dillingham. Late in this year's session of the legislature, Edgman introduced House Bill 199 to allow VPSOs to be armed. Edgman spoke to the bill early in Thursday's meeting.
My intent is that our legislation would make it possible for VPSOs to be armed in communities that agree to having an armed VPSO. That the intent is not to mandate that this would occur, but would only make the opportunity available to those communities who would wish to participate.
House Bill 199 and the companion legislation in the Alaska Senate were introduced shortly after the tragic shooting death of unarmed VPSO Thomas Madol in Manicotick back in March. It was the second time in the history of the program that a VPSO officer was killed in the line of duty. The VPSOs that operate in villages across the state are not actually state employees, despite the fact that they often work closely with the Alaska State Troopers. Instead, the VPSOs are most often employed by Native organizations, like the Bristol Bay Native Association, which operates the VPSO program in the Bristol Bay region. Currently, BB&A employs 14 VPSOs in the region. Ralph Anderson is the president and CEO of BB&A, and he participated in Thursday's meeting. Anderson confirmed that the BB&A Board of Directors has twice approved resolutions calling for allowing VPSO officers to be armed, and he noted that all of the current VPSO officers in the region support the change in policy.
It is unreasonable to expect peace officers to be unarmed in communities where virtually every household has firearms, and the VPSOs themselves are likely to own weapons for hunting. We also believe that the social environment of rural Alaska has changed dramatically in the past 30 years, that increased use of alcohol and dangerous drugs, such as methamphetamines and heroin, makes the VPSO's job even more hazardous.
Anderson stressed that before an officer could carry a gun, the officer should go through the appropriate training. He also called for the actual decision to be made locally about whether or not an officer should be allowed to carry a gun. The most moving testimony Thursday came from the widow of Thomas Madol, who was killed in the line of duty back in March in Manicotick. Madol was hired to be the VPSO officer in Manicotick in August of 2011, and Luann Madol says he was excited about the opportunity. However, she admitted that her husband was slightly hesitant about joining the program because of the prohibition in carrying firearms.
His desire to serve the village overshadowed his apprehension of being unarmed. He went with one thing in mind. He would give his all to make Manicotick a safer place by serving and protecting them, by sharing his faith and being the best employee possible.
The Village Public Safety Program in Alaska was started in the late 1970s, and funding for the program comes from the state of Alaska. However, the funds are distributed by the 9 regional Native nonprofit organizations and municipalities that sponsor the VPSOs in their villages. Representative Edgman's House Bill 199 to allow VPSOs to be armed has 15 co-sponsors in the House. Thursday's meeting was labeled as a work session and no official actions were taken. Representative Edgman says he intends to make passage of House Bill 199 a priority when the Alaska legislature goes back into session on January 21st of next year. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A 50-year-old man has died after being beaten with a road sign, punched and kicked outside the Anchorage Community Mental Health Services building. Four people are in custody. In a statement today, police identified the victim as Ferdinand Marquez, who lived in both California and Alaska, where he was a seasonal fishing boat employee. His body was found just before 7 a.m. Wednesday near the East Anchorage facility. Police say surveillance video from nearby businesses show Marquez was struck multiple times with a sign and then attacked by four suspects. Police say they have arrested 24-year-old David Wallent, 18-year-old Jarek Blankenship, 22-year-old Matt Martin, and 33-year-old Lewis Martin. All were to be arraigned today on murder charges. All except Lewis Martin also face robbery counts. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an iPhone app leads drivers right onto the Fairbanks Airport runway.
Both people were not from the Fairbanks area, and they were trying to get back to return rental cars and catch flights.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Legislation that passed Congress today will allocate $50 million to go toward cleanup of the 130 oil and gas wells that were drilled and abandoned by the federal government in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski helped negotiate the Responsible Helium Administration and Stewardship Act, which is expected to generate around $500 million in revenue over the next 10 years. Within the measure, she was able to insert language that guaranteed a portion of the money from the helium reserve sale would go toward the cleanup. Murkowski says it's an important step toward closing up the legacy wells.
That's huge for us. That is absolutely huge because you can assign priorities and say it's important that we clean it up, but until you have the dollars to make it happen, it doesn't happen. The administration has been tough to deal with on this, so I worked very, very hard to make sure that with the revenues from the helium sale, we could address this blight on our environment up north.
The $50 million will be distributed over the next 6 years. Because many federal priorities are competing for a decreasing amount of funds, Murkowski says previously she was only able to find small amounts of money for the cleanup.
When you just ran the numbers from a very general perspective, it was going to be 100-plus years to get through this, which was absolutely not an acceptable approach.
Even though the $50 million won't be enough to clean up all the wells, Murkowski says it should be enough to start making a dent. President Obama is expected to sign the measure into law. A State Department of Environmental Conservation official says proposed new fine particulate pollution regulations are designed more to meet federal requirements than clamp down on Fairbanks area residents who depend on wood for heat. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The proposed state smoke regulations released last week include the ability to ban wood burning when air quality dips severely. But DEC Non-Mobile Source Air Pollution Program Manager Cindy Heil says a ban would only be a last resort.
You know, a burn ban or curtailment is something we really are not looking to want to do.
Heil stresses that a burn ban would only be considered when pollution peaks and it would not cause other hardship.
The proposed levels that would trigger an episode is 56 micrograms per cubic meter in a 24-hour average. That only happened about 5 or 6 times last year. So it's only those extreme times. And then you would have to look at the conditions. If it's like 40 below zero, for example, and people have to have heat to make it through those cold temperatures, I mean, we would have to look on a case-by-case basis.
Heil says people without a backup heat source would never be stopped from using wood stoves and boilers, adding that burn ban enforcement still needs to be figured out. Heil says the DEC anticipates the Fairbanks North Star Borough wood stove and boiler changeout program, clean burning education programs, and ultimately access to lower-cost natural gas will improve local air. But the state still has to submit a compliance plan to the Environmental Protection Agency. The proposed regulations also include a list of approved heating fuels and a prohibition on the sale and new installation of non-EPA certified stoves and boilers. Heil points to one thing that's missing.
We really need to figure out some way to encourage the use of dry wood. Dry wood really has a benefit for air quality. And if we get more people to either change their behavior and cut their wood earlier, or if there was ways to find dry wood, either ship it in or something with dry wood, the borough was trying to do dryers or something, but some kind of program with dry wood could have a really good benefit.
Heil says the department hasn't been able to find a way to incorporate dry wood into regulations. The DEC control proposals have drawn some criticism for being too weak given health concerns leaked to breathing smoky air. Local air quality advocate Patrice Lee calls them toothless.
The regulations don't seem to change anything that we're doing now, and I think most people realize if you continue to do the same thing you've always done, it's unlikely you'll see a change. So I'm not sure how these regulations would bring us into attainment or help us create a state implementation plan that would be able to meet the EPA's approval or, you know, meet the goal of lowering the pollution in the borough.
The DEC's Heil says the proposed regulations were developed in close consultation with the EPA. The first in a series of DEC-sponsored public open houses on the proposed regs is scheduled for October 2nd. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
An iPhone map that led drivers across the Fairbanks International Airport runway has been deactivated. Airport spokeswoman Angie Spear says the map errantly directed users to the east side of the facility.
It would tell you to proceed down University Avenue, off onto Float Pond Road, down through Float Pond Road, around the General Aviation aircraft to Taxiway B, and it would tell you to turn on to Taxiway B and proceed straight ahead. And then at that point, the person that was using the app could see the terminal, and so they would assume that the app was leading them in the proper direction, and they would proceed and cross the runway and head straight to the terminal.
Spear says Apple was contacted after the iPhone map resulted in two people following it into a restricted area.
On September 6th, we had a runway incursion, and on September 20th, we had a runway incursion, and both people were not from the Fairbanks area, and they were trying to get back to return rental cars and catch flights.
Spear says there were no aircraft on the runway at the time of either incident, but it could have been a dangerous situation. She says the drivers followed their phones despite numerous roadside signs warning them not to proceed. Both drivers were issued citations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
Two longtime Alaskans are vying for an open seat on the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly. Both candidates for the District 1 seat have colorful backgrounds, although that's where their similarities end. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, a newcomer to borough politics is challenging a candidate with a long record in community service.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough's District 1 presents a unique set of challenges. It stretches from the outskirts of Palmer east along the Matanuska River and Glen Highway as far as Lake Louise, then north to the Denali Borough border. It encompasses wild and rural land, although many industrial development projects are slated for its undisturbed fields. Incumbent District 1 Assemblyman Warren Kehoe announced that he would not run for another term of office. Now longtime political agitator Jim Sykes is eyeing the upcoming vacancy.
And we need to grow a lot of sectors that are going to complement our life here in the valley.
Sykes has been active in Alaska's political scene for a couple of decades. He once ran for governor and can point to dozens of community and state issues that he has taken part in.
I've been open to a lot of different ideas across my journey of trying to do something good for communities. And what I've really done is tried to make sure people have a voice, and that's a strong voice, and they can participate in an open and honest process of government.
Sykes says it's the contentious problems that give people the chance to come together and forge solutions. He points to his record. He has run nonprofits, worked for the Alaska Native Review Commission, served on the Rail Belt Energy Advisory Board, and as the Lazy Mountain Community Council president. He advocates for alternative energy, lives in a house made of straw bales, and helped establish radio stations in Talkeetna and Palmer. He says he's got an innovative idea to monitor borough spending.
We need to put the borough checkbook online so everyone can see exactly how our taxpayer dollars are spent.
But aviator and challenger Doug Glenn says he'll bring new energy to the assembly. He built up his Glenn Air business in Palmer the old-fashioned way.
In high school, throwing bags for Woods Air Service and just moving freight. And worked for them for quite a few years, and that got me sucked into the aviation business, and here I'm stuck. So been doing my thing with airplanes ever since.
First-time candidate Glenn grew up in Palmer and is a grad of Palmer High. He has three children, two now in borough schools. He says he's worried about their future.
My reason for doing this is more for my kids than anything. I realize there are no decent family wage jobs around here, and I know everybody's getting sick and tired of hearing that. No family wage job deal, but it's a fact. You know, there's Walmart jobs, and which I'm not knocking anybody that works for a living, but these $12 an hour jobs don't cut it. And it's hard to buy a $250,000 house making 12 bucks an hour.
Glenn is taking a strong pro-development stance. He is in favor of the Susitna Dam project, the transportation initiative, and a bridge across Kinnick Arm.
And the traffic on Kinnick Goose Bay Road is truly unbelievable. And anybody that says that bridge isn't necessary needs to take a cruise out there.
District 1 is the site of proposed coal mining projects within the borough, projects that have divided communities and created a backlash of opposition among some borough residents. Sykes says he's taking a long-range view of coal development. He says it would be years before any actual mining could happen, and that gives people time to discuss the issue and find solutions. Glenn, who does aerial reclamation work for Usabelli Coal, says Sutton locals he's talked to support coal mining.
90% of the people I've talked to, a strong 90%, are in favor of that mine opening up.
Sykes doesn't deny that development needs to happen, but he says representation is all about getting people involved in their own government.
Because I'm part of this valley, and I really will work with anybody, and that's my reputation, and I think that that's what we need more of, rather than just trying to see any problem that comes up through the lens of some particular agenda.
On October 1st, it'll be up to Valley voters to decide. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Athletes at East High in Anchorage highlighted some positive statistics about teens earlier today at the homecoming pep rally, like the fact that 89% of Anchorage high school students don't smoke. The campaign is called Strength of Our Youth. The idea is to debunk the myths that everyone in high school is making bad choices. Astrid Williams is a senior at East High School and has been organizing the project. She says the pep rally seemed like a great way to get the message out.
We were thinking of really, you know, fun ways to get the information from the survey to the students, you know, rather than just handing them a piece of paper. So what we did was put it into a pep assembly and kind of put it in that way so the kids have a opportunity to hear the percentages, not just to read them.
What's some of the information that's in this brochure? What are you trying to highlight to the students?
We're trying to highlight the positive things that teens are doing, and the kind of idea behind this is that if teens know that other teens are not, you know, for example, not drinking, not smoking cigarettes, then they'll follow that positive behavior as well. So just kind of those type of facts, like we trust more than one adult other than a teacher or a parent. We are not drinking, or, you know, a percentage of us have never been smoking, have not done marijuana, those type of facts.
What kind of reception have you had from other students? What are you hearing?
I think it's very positive. I think teens are surprised about the percentages, which I think is a good thing. And also, when SAB was contacted, we thought the parents should know the information as well, because many parents don't know the positive things that teens are doing. So that's really interesting.
You mentioned that some of the teens were surprised by the percentages. Mm-hmm. Are you hoping that what will happen out of this is that people realize it's cool to not smoke and it's cool to not drink rather than the other way around?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely the goal, to have people realize that the strength of our youth is, you know, not doing stuff that's bad. And I really, that's the, like, the goal. And especially during homecoming, there's a focus on sports and football and stuff. And it's to get the kids involved into sports, involved into organized activities, which will in turn, you know, reduce them from, you know, having spare time and maybe drinking or smoking or something like that.
You're in high school, so you know that some kids have more support mm-hmm. than other kids. Some have great cohesive families, or they have extended friends and neighbors that help them out. Some kids don't. Mm-hmm. How do you see this reaching out to the kids that are the most vulnerable for the things that we're discussing right now, smoking, drinking, drugs?
I think having a really good support group, especially in high school, is very important. And one of the things that was mentioned at the pep assembly by an adult is that all the staff at the high schools, you know, at the high school level are very supportive. So even if they do not have the family support that, you know, they need, they have the counselors and the teacher and, like, the support of the actual staff, which I think is really, really important.
Where do you hope to take the project from here?
I'm hoping that it goes to all the high schools, not just East. And I know there's, you know, stuff in the works as far as that. But I hope that the information really gets to teens, and teens actually realize that they don't have to do this to be cool. And it's much more healthy not to do, you know, smoke or drink. You know, it's healthy to eat fruit, it's healthy to eat vegetables. And that's all kind of part of the Strength of the Youth survey.
Astrid Williams is a senior at East High School. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.